Welcome to the Interspecies Future podcast. I'm your host, Bridie Addison Child. Interspecies Future is an initiative by Berlin-based art foundation LAS, marking the beginning of a multi-decade civilizational journey in advancing the new rights and opportunities for non-human life on Earth, as made possible by the emergence of planetary-scale computing. This is episode 8, the last in our current series, where we're considering pathways forward for the interspecies. Today's guests are Andrea Leiter of Sovereign Nature Initiative and Ted Schmidt from the Allen Institute for AI.
What would it mean to think of non-economical value? How can we express it? What mechanisms can we find?
We do try to apply some of these technologies into some of the communities and get some momentum from the bottom up. And I think there's a real opportunity to do that.
I think the question then of interspecies encounter raises the question of on whose grounds, on whose terms?
That's a systems change, and that takes all hands on deck to make happen.
Taking in the content from the Interspecies Future Symposium in Berlin on the 9th and the 10th of July, in this episode we ask how to take interspecies work forward. We consider available technologies, resources, the problems we face, as well as philosophical challenges of an interspecies future, such as how to conceive of rights for other species. We also ask how best we can use technology as a tool in the context of the climate crisis. Could you both just introduce yourselves?
I'm Ted Schmidt. I'm the Director of Conservation at the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. I've been working in the intersection of conservation and technology now for about 12 years and really finding ways to create solutions that are grounded in the problem space and spent a lot of time in Africa really working on the ground with the people in the field there, and more recently now focused on maritime security and particularly the problem of illegal fishing.
My name is Andrea Leiter, and I am a co-founder and the director of research at the Sovereign Nature Initiative, which is a very young initiative. It's been not quite a year and a bit since we've been incorporated. So we are really at the moment figuring out the way we want to develop technology in order to work meaningfully at this intersection of identity and value and reconfiguring these terms through technology and theory and art, the three pillars with which we work at SNI. And I am also an assistant professor at the University of Amsterdam in global and sustainable global economic law. So the push, I think, that comes from my direction is really one that is concerned with inequality and with normative systems that on the one hand sustain and enable that inequality, and on the other hand also try to remedy it, which I think is the key core feature of law in all its forms and shapes, that it does both of these things at once.
Thank you both for joining me today. I thought it might be useful just to ground us in the conversation with a short quote from Do Trees Have Standing, which is the article published by Christopher Stone in the 1970s, and many people kind of consider, as I'm sure you know, a seminal moment in the environmental movement. And he says, "Each time there is a movement to confer rights onto some new entity, the proposal is bound to sound odd or frightening or laughable. And this is partly because until the rightless thing receives its rights, we cannot see it as anything but a thing for the use of us, those who are holding rights at the time." So that quote is talking about a very specific interspecies future, which is conferring rights in a legal context. But I do think it speaks really to a conceptual problem of creating a shift of this magnitude in people's thinking. So with that in mind, I wonder, what does interspecies future thinking mean to both of you? And what would it mean to activate those ideas of an interspecies future?
So I think for me, there are different kind of levels on which engagement has to happen. Because I think on the one hand, we live with a certain urgency of moving, of doing something, of getting active. And I think that projects like advancing a rights of nature discourse, advancing granting rights to nature, trying to do what you just said, to bring the status from object to subject, away from use, away from ecosystem service, toward a something like a self-governing, self-valuing entity, I think is an important move. And I think that that also has a lot of traction in the world. I think there's good reason for that, because there's an understanding that we need to start thinking in this direction. On the other hand, I also think that the rights of nature discourse comes with its very own limitations. And I think one of them might be of a more pragmatic character, which is the question of how does that relate to the economy and to the pressure of economic exploitation of natural resources? So in which way can subjectivity of a tree, a river, or other object withstand those economic pressures? How is that going to help? And on a less pragmatic, but maybe let's say more philosophical level, I think the question then of interspecies encounter raises the question of on whose grounds, on whose terms. And there I think that there is a beautiful book by the philosopher Elisabeth Povinelli. And one of the books that she wrote, it's an older book of hers already, but it has a fantastic title. It's called The Cunning of Recognition. And I think that this is precisely a little bit what we have to think about. So recognition of rights of nature, great, it's recognition, but there is a certain price that is being paid, which is the price that it's recognition on human terms, which means that whatever is what we imagine the natural world to be has to mold itself into the legal forms that humans offer. And I think that's a problem to a degree if we are serious about an interspecies future. But what the solution to that is yet to be written on a different page. But I think maybe for kicking us off, I think that's a little bit how I would see that.
Great, I'll jump in. Yeah, a really challenging and important topic. You know, I think I've spent a lot of time recently, and you know, people have over the last 40 years when the first sort of ecosystem services thinking and papers started coming out about how we internalize nature and wildlife biodiversity into our economic system. And it mostly hasn't worked. We haven't even got carbon right, for instance, let alone biodiversity, which is actually a lot harder than getting carbon right. And I think about, and I've been thinking a lot about that, but then, as you said, sort of conferring rights on nature, you know, we have the Convention on Human Rights. And yet we, if we think about it, you know, the native indigenous people, 200-300 years and before that, they thought it was odd when these Europeans came and said that, no, you can own land. And I know the Native Americans were like, you can't own land, it's not possible. And so it was just this bizarre thinking from their perspective. And so the land already had rights, and effectively from their point of view, you know, Western cultures took away the rights of land, if you want to put it that way. I don't know that anybody's quite put it that way before. And so, you know, there are these two paths. There's, okay, it does have value or economic value, and therefore we have to internalize it into the economic system. And the other path, of course, is actually it has rights, like we humans assert that we have rights, sort of fundamental rights. I think we push on both. I think we have to. Frankly, we don't do a very good job of giving humans the rights that we say they have. You know, there's the UN Convention on Human Rights, and yet you can look anywhere in the world and see that those rights are violated. Particularly, they're violated when there's economic incentive for them to be violated. So I think we have to push on both of them. I think human rights have made tremendous progress all over the world, even though we still see massive failings everywhere. Can we push on rights for nature, rights for wildlife and biodiversity, while at the same time trying to incorporate and internalize them into what frankly is the global capitalist system. And there's really, I think, no choice but to do both those things.
Yeah, I mean, I have a question here about how we should conceive of value, because as you mentioned, Ted, under global capitalist order, value is construed very specifically. And AI at the moment, I would argue, is a hyper-capitalist space. And Andrea, you know, you have this legal background, and legal systems are ways of building and construing and conferring relationships and values. So if we're trying to work within these systems, how should we be conceiving of value in them? And how should we be thinking about that in relation to other species?
I think that the question of value is really at the center, to my in my mind, at least. I think it's precisely the notion that has the potential to bridge the economic pressures with whatever we call values of a society, which comes maybe close to what we understand law to be doing. In some ways, that law encodes certain values as to how we want to live as a society. And I think that the question of what is value and how can value be expressed is really one where we need as much creativity and trying out as we can. Because I think that we think of value as economic value first and foremost, no? And then it's a matter of supply and demand. The price mechanism distributes magically in the best possible way. But through the price mechanism, we are really equalizing everything into a number. So everything that is incommensurable becomes commensurable through squeezing it into this form of the number. And I think that is where a lot of the problems come from this equalizing in one numeric term. On the other hand, when we speak about values in law, we have a little bit the problem that it is very detached from life in many ways. So the problem of what about, why do we see so many violations of human rights? What is going on there? One way of looking at this is to just really think about the lived experience and how many layers of translation are necessary so that you can even come to something like a European Court of Human Rights or even in a national jurisdiction in front of a constitutional court. What has to be mediated? How much has to be mediated that you get there? So I do think that there is a problem that comes from these forms of both law and the price number that depends on so much mediation of what is incommensurable life. And these concepts are very powerful and we operate with them. And it is very hard to think value outside of these terms or differently. But I would say, what would it mean to think of non-economical value? How can we express it? What mechanisms can we find? At the risk of jumping the gun there a little bit, this is one of the reasons why I do think that token economics and blockchain technology, despite all the problems and the really gigantic problems that it comes with, is something that is interesting to look at.
Great points. One thing I always say about, I'll take from a technology perspective, is technology is, technologists love to think about that technology can solve everything. The problem is, I think technologists often can't be bothered with the problem. They like to think about the solutions. And the fact is, technology is a tool. It can be used for good or bad or indifferent. It allows us to scale, a word that I sometimes really don't like, but we talk a lot about scale. And when you talk about scale, all the little values and things sort of get lost in that. And I think, if we think about how hard it is for we humans to quantify value, and I liked how you put, putting a number on everything. I think technology lets you do that very powerfully, but it does it, frankly, without values. The values are imposed on it by the humans that are creating it. And we already see lots of concerns and articles and research about how biases that the programmers have that build these algorithms get built into the AI. How do we address that? This is actually what the Allen Institute for AI was set up to do. It's AI for good, really to think about these problems of ethics and applied into AI and how they get embedded into the algorithms. If you're building an algorithm to, say, drive a car autonomously, you know, you're looking for obstacles and things. Those are pretty binary things. And yet, even there, you get ethical questions about, you know, do I run over three people or run over one person if that's my choice, right? Well, how do you program that into a system? And I think when we think about that applied to species, you know, how do we embody in the technology the ethics, really, and the law into the technology? And I think that's a huge challenge for technologists, and one that they don't, frankly, like to take on. Because it is so hard, and it does require lots of fuzzy things that engineers tend not to like. So I'll stop there.
You spoke there about technology as a tool, not as a solution. And I just want to push on that a little bit because you know, as humans, we have caused this problem, which is the imminent ecological collapse of the planet. Is it really the case that more technology is going to fix that problem? Kind of what's the line there? What's the balance?
That is such an important question, because every time we humans try to fix something, we end up making it worse, almost invariably. And yet we've made a lot of things better. There are a lot fewer people, at least in a percentage way, in poverty than there used to be. And we could communicate with each other all over the world instantly. That's, of course, turned out to be good and bad, but I think mostly good. So I think more technology is not necessarily going to solve things, but I think given, and I'll go back to that word scale, given the scale and the magnitude of the problem we've created, I think that we don't have any choice but to bring scalable solutions, but those solutions have to be really grounded in a deep understanding of the problem. And so when we build the solutions, we need to build them understanding what problems we're trying to solve and also thinking about potential unintended consequences and trying to get ahead of those. And that's where we need other disciplines thinking about what those unintended consequences could be, which we often don't do.
Yeah, I think maybe I can add a little bit to this question, because it seems and it feels as if we also have reached the limits of our knowledge capacity, the way how we know the world. So I think that we just are realizing that the way we know how to even frame a problem is not, it doesn't really get to the point. It really doesn't do the job. So that is, I think, something that really, at least to the way I see it, cuts across natural science in that sense, as well as law and other humanities disciplines, where the big question becomes, so if knowing with precision is not the way how we can solve problems, if somehow this mode of acting in the world has shown its limitations, where can we turn? And I think that it is a very scary proposition and it's a very scary question. But I think that the fact that we can now grasp the limits of how far we can get with the modes of knowledge that we have, that is in the air. That can be felt. What do we do with that now? I think that's the big question. So I think on the one hand, we keep trying with the modes of knowledge that we have to fix and to do what we can. But I also think that the reason for not really succeeding fully with that is because the way of operating with these modes of knowledge is already problematic. And I mean, to make this maybe a little more concrete, if we think about biodiversity. So it's not just that we don't know the majority of species in the world and that we only know like a little part of the variety. Even with that knowledge, we are utterly failing to indeed protect or cohabit or do anything the like. So I think it's really a limit of knowing and then building solutions based on that knowledge that we are facing. And that is very, very paralyzing and uncomfortable. And so I think that then technological fixes are very popular because they make you feel potent, they make you feel able, they make you feel in charge. And I think that's a big conundrum. And I have no clear proposition as to where to go, because I think the urgency is so big that we also might not have the time to reconsider our knowledge apparatus from the scratch, which I think is a very worthy project.
I think that what Andrea just said is actually quite profound. We're creating solutions to problems that we only partially understand, very partially and very slightly understand. And yet we are inclined to do that because it makes us feel empowered to do it. And at the same time, we also have folks who are pushing against anything that any of us who are concerned about these issues propose, because they're profiting and benefiting from the system the way it is. And so they don't want to change things. I definitely wake up some days thinking the only way that we will actually make the sort of system changes we need to make is when we're in critical fail mode, when our cities are burning down. I mean, it's already, I'm sitting here in Seattle today, and we've had unhealthy air conditions for 3 days because the forests in eastern Washington are burning down, and we can't go outside because the air quality is so bad. And yet we're not making any changes. So we're starting to see the system fail, starting to truly fail in so many ways, and yet we still don't have any consensus to act. And when we do act, it is towards those technological solutions that are inherently built based on partial knowledge. I say all of that, and Andrea said all of that, and it sounds rather depressing. It sounds like, well, let's just throw up our hands and give up because we can't solve it. And of course, I don't think any of us would say that. We do need to have these conversations. There are great people in all fields doing lots of great work, and we have to keep doing that work. I always get frustrated with people talk about you have to have hope, and I always think of hope as such a minimum bar. Yes, of course we have to have hope, but then we have to do the hard work. And so there are people doing a lot of hard work. And on the technology side, I really like theory of change thinking, because it makes you think all the way from the problem and what you're trying, what you want the world to look like, all the way back to all the actions it takes to realize that vision of the world. And on the AI side and the technology side, there's a lot of good work going on to understand all the activity that's going on and quantify it. So take fishing. We know there's overfishing, but we don't know how much, or we haven't known how much, and we haven't known what impacts. We do now have a lot of data, and the technology is helping us get better and better about having a knowledge of what's going on. And up to now, that data has been pretty coarse in terms of temporal and spatial granularity. And that means that the policy instruments and the other things you put in place have to be coarse, because the data you have is quite coarse. And I think what AI and all the technology that's being developed, all the satellites that are being put in the air and so on, are going to allow us, or in the process of allowing us, to have a much better temporal and spatial granularity to the data, so that we could see changes, we can really understand at a quite granular level what's going on, how rapidly it's going on. And then of course, it's up to the lawyers, the politicians, all the policy people to take that data and use it for policy, to use it for management. But frankly, the policy and the management folks haven't had anything but quite coarse-grained data to make decisions with. So that's a problem that actually a technologist can solve, is to provide the level of specificity, of granularity to do. There's been a lot of different terms applied to it. Planetary computer, heartbeat of the planet, pulse of the planet. You might have heard some of these terms. But I think we're going to have to get there. And that's a very positive thing that technology can do. Now, and then I'll hand it back to Andrea, because what is done with that? That's up to the lawyers and the politicians and folks. So hopefully the technologists can get it to a place where no one could claim they didn't know what was going on. I think I'll stop there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, I think it's on many different layers. So I'm going to hope, together with TED, that the policymakers in charge of the good policies will do really good stuff with the increased data input and let's say more granular knowledge that can be obtained. But I would still maybe go at it from a different direction and add that to it. And again, to also say, I really do think that there is not that one way of how we can go about it. I really think we need to experiment. We need to try different paths. But I think one of the things that to me at least sounds interesting and promising is to try and take off a little bit the economic pressures by working on a smaller scale through token economic systems, by trying really in a smaller scale in an experimental way to think about value systems of value production and distribution that maybe not yet underlie these grand pressures of commodification and of exchange for profit. And so I think that this is just one way in which, and I think there are many different ways of how people are experimenting with that. And it's crypto and token economics play a certain role in that because that has made it accessible for certain communities where that was not the case yet. But I mean, complementary currencies are not an invention of yesterday. Complementary currencies have been around for a long time. And this question of like, how can you localize an economy? What can you do in a localized economy? How can you change the economy in that way is really, I think, something that has been around for some time. But I think maybe with the advent of blockchain receives a certain push to also potentially interact with other kinds of localized systems. So the interoperability between different kinds of tokens can maybe be mediated in an easier way. And we come to the scalability that TED invoked, where what maybe in the past was always a very localized, nice to have project can now potentially become beginnings of working toward an alter economy. And I believe that the way to go for this is really to have communities. And now speaking of ecology and conservation, I think it would have to be communities that work the way they do already, but now maybe are handed tools to express values and different kinds of values within their working sets in some way. And from there, it can grow. So this is something that I think is something that does not necessarily depend from the good policymakers, which again, I think you're right, is a level that has to work. But I think that also these more grassrootsy approaches can really bring us, really can open up the potential for alter economies, for different economies.
I completely agree with that. And you know, I think if I go to the Earth Ranger tool that we built, we started actually at the very grassroots. We worked with a small number of protected area managers and the communities around them to show that you could change the way parks are managed through technology. They could be managed more effectively and efficiently and in a more integrated way. And now, 7 years on, we have government signing up. So, we came from the bottom up and they really needed to see those examples of how things could be managed differently. And we couldn't go from the top down. In fact, I think that's a challenge that some of the large conservation NGOs tend to go from the top down. I think you need to do both, but they tend to start always with the governments and feel like we have to start at the top with the policy changes at the government level and then push solutions down. And I think that can work, but I think you really do have to go from the bottom up. And, you know, coming out of the Interspecies Symposium, I think one of the action items that I'd like to see happen there is that we do find some examples. We do try and apply some of these technologies into some of the communities, demonstrate, create case studies about how this can work. and get some momentum from the bottom up. And I think there's a real opportunity to do that. And I hope to see that happen, because I think I have seen it, that approach work already at least once with EarthRanger in quite a significant way.
Ted, there you were talking about bottom-up change. And Andrea, I'd really love to hear more about Sovereign Nature Initiative and the purpose of that work. Kind of what are you hoping to achieve with that?
Yeah, super. Yeah, I mean, I do think that Sovereign Nature Initiative is really trying to work on two different concepts. One is the question of identity. The second is the question of value. So these two that you so beautifully introduced also at the beginning, the question of value already, is really at the heart of what we are trying to do. The question of identity relates to how do you even conceive of the world around you? Like, how do you cut? Where does a tree start? Where does it end? If the tree is supposed to be in some form represented, that always means that there has to be a cut and the tree has to be defined in a certain way. So one of the big questions, I think, in ecological work is precisely this work of how do you do that? And what does it mean to identify? And so here, what we are trying to do with SNI is to try to find ways of a more dynamic and maybe more bottom-up processes of identification, which can, in a sense, go in and out. So trying to overlay different data sets of how different institutions, different projects understand what they are seeing. So it's not that you start with the lion, but you start with a data set that says there is a path that the lion walked, which is based on the geodata of the tracker. And then maybe you have like cameras that are motion sensitive, and then you have one image that comes from here. So you have different data sets that presumably relate to an object, which could be the lion. But what we are trying to disassemble is precisely this immediate jump to saying, this is the lion, and trying to keep it on the level of saying, these are layers that make up something, that make up a particular world and a particular object in that world, but to try and keep them more dynamic and try to keep them in conversation with other data sets. So this is one direction at which we work with the technology that we are trying to develop. And the other area is what I already mentioned, is precisely the question of value and token economics, where we try to experiment different modes of governance, different modes of value expression through token economics, but they are all both, again, community-based. So this is what SNI has set out to do, to work in these ways. And this is where we are experimenting. We are not very far yet with these experiments, but this is the plan.
I think fascinating that the first thing you talked about, essentially you're trying to de-atomize and systematize the thinking and get rid of sort of atomatized thinking. I that is so frankly profound and yet something almost no one thinks about. So that systems, I mean, if you think of, we throw the word ecosystem around a lot. Technologists talk about building technology ecosystems, which actually is kind of ironic if you think about it, but we don't think of systems as a whole. We tend to like to break them down and atomize them. So I think that's a fantastic direction. And I think when I think about some of the things we've done, that's actually, in a way, what we're trying to do is by being able to quantify all of the things acting in the system, we're trying to visualize the system as a whole. Both EarthRanger and Skylight do that. There are other platforms that do that. I've mentioned a lot of this thinking around the planetary computer. The idea being that if you can get at the right level all of the inputs into the system, then you can think about the system as a whole instead of having to break it down into these atomized parts that you can understand. And I think that's something that we haven't done with the technology enough yet. I haven't done a lot of work in climate science, but we do have a climate team at AI2. And this, of course, is where they tend to live, is in this systems level thinking. And I think we've done far too little of that on the biological side of things. And I think we have to do that a lot more.
Yeah, super cool. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that is really, I think you expressed it so well, that it really tries to move away from this atomized thinking and tries to think in the systems and in the ecosystems idea, but as well trying to really highlight the interdependence. And this is something that I maybe didn't say yet with where the value and the identity question meet, is by trying to express also that there is an interdependence in the value. So these different data sets relate to each other in various ways, which also means that they, I mean, at this stage, only really in a symbolic way, we try to express that there is an interdependence. And if something happens to the data set, does that that says something about the moisture of a particular plot of land, then that has a relationship to the animal that lives in that area. So to try and bring out that there is a dependence between these things and the value of each of them and the whole thing together depends on each other, that is something that we are also trying to showcase, at least now in a stylized way, because doing it for real, again, we come back to the question of knowledge and the limitations of what we can know. So I'm not even chasing the fantasy of one day being able to do it really. It remains stylized because there is a limit to the way we know, and that is a limit that we can't overcome with the modes that we know. But it nevertheless, I think, is effective to show that there is such an interrelatedness. And I think that that is really something that if we could build together, Ted, more on the technology side to do this systems thinking rather than the atomized thinking, I think that would be a really good step.
I absolutely agree, and I'd be very interested in doing that. And I think the thing that I liked the most about the conference, the interspecies conference, the symposium, was that it was all these different perspectives that don't come together very often. And I think that needs to happen a lot more. I would say where we've made the most progress bringing technology to actually do real good in conservation, as opposed to just sounding like it's doing good, but not really doing any impact on the ground, is when we've brought the technologists to meet with the field people on the ground and understand the problems, always grounding in the problem space. And I think what the symposium did was it brought together people with legal perspectives, people with technology perspectives, creatives with, you know, how to speak to people through media, and all of these different perspectives coming together to get the kind of interdisciplinary thinking we need to create real systems change. And a lot of what we just talked about is really about systems change. It's about changing our legal frameworks. It's about changing how we build technology. It's about changing how we think of rights, by whether it's by land, by animals, by people. It's really, that's a systems change. And that takes all hands on deck to make happen.
Yeah, I very much agree. I think it's really, I think one of the big questions is how can this kickstart that has been done somehow lead to a little more exchange and a little more indeed putting your thinking together. I mean, I think one of the big questions is for me, and that ties into the whole question of what's the role of the economy, is also how can we fund this work? How can we fund the work that is happening in these areas? Because the projects are really big, the challenges are enormous, and the way that the economy is set up, it's not so easy to make a strong case for funding this. So I do think that in the same way in which we think that we have to rethink the economy for conservation purposes, I also think we have to rethink the economy for research purposes and for really like what kind of value is being produced through something like the Interspecies Conference. I mean, you won't be able to put an economic tag on it and a price number on it and say, well, that sells on the market for XYZ. And yet so much good work is happening there. And I think that in order to be able to do more of this kind of good work, we do have to really think about the basis of value and how we assign value to things. So maybe we can even think about modes of trying this experiment with thinking about value otherwise in the very way we work. So I would very much like to see a little bit of experimentation in this regard.
I agree. I think the funding is critical, and yet this is very risky stuff. There's going to have to be a lot of experimenting and a lot of dead ends. I think that tends to not be well suited to government funding. Governments like sure bets because the politicians need to show their constituents that they're delivering on something. This feels very in the air, and yet the scale of the problem probably requires governments to be involved. So how do we carve that space out? Can we attract some philanthropy and entrepreneurship into the space? I have been approached by a few entrepreneurial folks who sense a real opportunity, an economic opportunity, understanding and have an appetite for the risk, as venture capitalists do. But how do we drive this forward? And I think starting very small with some experiments, case studies. So what I would say, what I'm hoping will be a follow-up out of the symposium is that we got an interesting group of folks together. Let's come together and think of a couple of case studies where we can bring some of the interspecies money, perhaps, idea that Jonathan has, and really experiment with that in the field, create some examples and build a little bit of momentum, and slowly build the momentum that where we can start to show others, governments or whoever, could bring more funding in. I think that's the right way anyway, because you don't want to do large experiments with large amounts of money that fail and then get everyone soured on the whole idea. You really want to start with small amounts of money, small groups of people that are very agile and willing to collaborate. And then I'll just keep emphasizing really interdisciplinary thinking. You need people who are very open-minded and have very are interdisciplinary by their nature to be able to work with people who don't think like them.
Thank you both so much for this conversation. I'm personally really looking forward to seeing how interspecies work can move forward.
Thank you. Great chatting with you, and I do hope we follow up.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was a great pleasure. Thanks a lot to both of you. Very good.
This podcast is produced on the occasion of the Interspecies Future Symposium in July 2022. Co-hosted by Light Art Space and the Museum for Natterkunde in Berlin. The symposium has been orchestrated and convened by the chairs, Kenrick Aledo-McDowell and Jonathan Ledyard, with Bettina Carmes and Johannes Vogel. The wider programme has been curated by Light Art Space Head of Programmes Amira Gad, with Corinne Minat as co-organiser of the Interspecies Future Symposium and surrounding activities. This series is produced and hosted by me, Bridie Addison-Child. It is a reduced listening production supported by Light Art Space.